Grüezi miteinander, ganz herzlich willkommen und einen wunderschönen guten Tag, meine sehr verehrten Damen und Herren, liebe Freunde aus nah und fern. Ich darf Sie begrüßen einmal mehr zu einer Sondersendung von Weltwoche Daily, die andere Sicht. Ich habe es in der letzten Woche schon angekündigt, dass ich mit dem britischen Ex-Diplomaten Alistair Crook nach dem Ukraine-Krieg und der geopolitischen Dimension des Ringens da um Eurasien in einer zweiten Sendung dieses fürchterliche Problemfeld Gaza und Nahostkonflikt etwas näher beleuchten möchte. Und Alistair Crook, für alle, die nicht dabei gewesen sind beim letzten Mal, er ist ein hochdekorierter britischer Ex-Diplomat und er hat eine enorme Expertise im Nahen Osten. Er hat dort als Konfliktforscher und Konfliktlöser mit hochrangigen Politikern aus der Europäischen Union, aber auch aus den Vereinigten Staaten von Amerika zusammengearbeitet. Er war mittendrin bei Waffenstillstandsverhandlungen. Er ist ein großer Kenner der nahöstlichen Kampfzone gewissermaßen und Alistair Crook ist auch Direktor des Conflicts Forum, das ja in seinem Namen schon sozusagen den Anspruch, den Auftrag trägt, Konflikte zu entschärfen, Konflikte zu lösen. Und ich möchte hier gleich am Anfang herausstreichen, ich bin kein Experte des Nahostkonflikts und das ist eine sehr gute Voraussetzung, denn dann kann ich hoffentlich die einfachen Fragen stellen, die auch unsere Zuschauer, die auch Sie beschäftigen. Ich freue mich sehr. And now I will switch to English. Dear Alistair Crook, welcome again on our program and thanks for your time. And yeah, let's jump into the difficult minefields of the Middle East.
That's fine. And I'm very happy to be on your program. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And I can say that our viewers were very much impressed by your analysis of the whole conundrum in Eurasia, in the Ukraine, between Russia, between the European Union, between the United States, and how these conflicts also are interlinked with what is happening in the Middle East. But let's start with the current events. Of course, you have noticed that the International Court in Den Haag is about to probably or thinks about putting an indictment or a Haftbefehl, a Strafbefehl against the leader of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, and one of his ministers, and three Hamas leaders. What's your reaction to these proceedings here in Den Haag?
Well, my reaction will probably go against the sort of general view about how this is going to work out in the Middle East. And for that, I just need to explain some very basic things about where we are in terms of Israel and its politics, because I think many viewers are troubled by these things. They don't understand when people talk about biblical eschatological conflict, and they say, well, you know, we don't really understand this. So I just want to explain that just over a year ago, there was a huge change, a really tectonic plate change in Israel that took place. And that was in the elections. And for the first time in the elections, and my wife, who's lived in also in the region for a long time, suddenly turned to me and she said, "My goodness, the Mizrahi are going into the Prime Minister's office." And I said, "No." And she said, "Yes, they're the government now." And just to make it clear for your listeners and your viewers, the Mizrahi are the Jews who come from the region, from the Arab world and from Africa, North Africa. And the majority in Israel before has always been Ashkenazi. Ashkenazi are generally the Jews who have come from Europe, and they are more liberal, and they are the, if you like, very much Europeanized, Americanized, if you like, too, the Ashkenazi. And the Mizrahi have always been the underclass in Israel. They've been the ones that don't get the good jobs. They live in not such a nice parts of towns. They're not like Tel Aviv and Herzliya and these smart areas where the, you know, the elites live. And the Mizrahi, again, I just need to give this little bit of background so people understand this. The Mizrahi have a very different view of Judaism and a very different view, and they don't like the Ashkenazi, the Europeanized Jews at all. They regard them as liberal and untrustworthy. And the it was Begin years ago in 48 who saw that the Mizrahi, who then were a minority, could be brought in first into Irgun, which was, if you like, a sort of terrorist organization. It was behind the bombing of the King David Hotel and other exploits. This was at the time of 48, and it was a violent period. And then the Mizrahi came into the Likud, and they're now basically the sort of bedrock of the Likud. But now they are in the cabinet, and they have a majority in the cabinet. So when you hear about Ben-Gavir, Smotrich, Levin, Dot, these are all Mizrahi from this, allied now with the religious right in Israel. And this is a majority in the cabinet.
May I just jump in here, because it's highly interesting what you're saying, referring to Menachem Begin and the founding of Israel also. What is the reason that the Mizrahi could gain this position in Israel? What's the deeper root cause of this ascent?
It is basically because of religion, and they're much more religious, if you like. The European, if you like, Ashkenazi are largely secular and happy with things as they are. But when the Mizrahi came into to government, and I think this will give you the explanation that you've just asked me, they came in with a radical different program, very different from the sort of secular liberal program of the Ashkenazi. And this had three main points. The first of which was that they, and this was the prime one, to found Israel on the land of Israel. And that means founding Israel from the river to the sea, at least, you know, because greater Israel, the borders might go up to go Euphrates or go up to the Litani in Lebanon too, but certainly from the Jordan to the Mediterranean, that they wanted to found Israel. Translated in plain English, it says no Palestinian state at all. And that has been their explicit program. No, Smotrich, who's a member of the cabinet and a government minister, I mean, some years ago, I remember Rahim writing and said, you know, it's time to take the Palestinian state issue off the table. No Palestinian state. We're not going to have Arabs living here unless they accept our domination, effectively, put it more sophisticatedly than that. But that's it. Or else they go. That's it. So that was the first point. The second point was we are going to found the third temple. The third Jewish temple on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. And just to be clear again, that meant demolishing Al-Aqsa. Al-Aqsa Mosque is, in a way, a real icon of Islam, not just in a sort of narrow sense, but in the sense of the whole civilization of Islam over 1,000 years. It is neither Sunni nor Shi'i. It is not Muslim Brotherhood or Salafist or Wahhabi. It is a symbol of Islam in the most sort of essential way, more so than Mecca or Medina, because I have to afraid to say the Saudis have tended to turn that into a shopping center, and it's lost its sort of appeal for many Muslims. So that was the second thing. Is of course, founding the Temple Mount meant knocking down Al-Aqsa. Destroying Al-Aqsa. And the third element was the introduction of halakhic law, that is Jewish law, and the Talmud. And they wanted, and they were quite clear about this, we want a Jewish state, a much more Jewish state. And hence, you'll understand that sort of explains the sort of their disdain for these European Jews who they see are compromisers, who are prepared to compromise on a sort of Palestinian state that would stop a real Jewish state coming into existence. When Israel was founded, perhaps Israel was more or less 80% Ashkenazi. Mm-hmm. And now the Mizrahi and their allies on the right, including the Haredi, that's the Orthodox Jews that you see wearing caps and have religious symbols on them, into power, then they have a plurality in Israel. Mm-hmm. And it reflected also a big change that was taking place politically. Because in the last 10 years since Netanyahu was in government, Israel has moved strongly to the right. I mean, very firmly to the right during this period. And what is most striking is that the young Israelis are at the forefront. I mean, they are more right than their parents. Unlike, you know, in other parts of the world where the young tend to be more liberal than their parents or more radical than the parents, it's the other way around. The right has got its feet in this period. And so you have to understand Israeli politics at the moment, you have to understand that this was the time nearly 10 years ago that those that form the government now broke with the Democratic Party. This was a time when the Democratic Party of the United States was becoming more wokish and liberal and talking about the need for, those identities that had been repressed or hurt during this had to be compensated for. And they could all read the signs that this meant the Democratic Party would become more Palestinian than it had been, because wokeism, the moral content of that, would naturally lead. And that was the point at which Netanyahu shifted his support to the Republican evangelical. The evangelical was the pathway through. It was the evangelicals that managed to get the American embassy moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And so that was the other big shift that was taking place in this time. And now we have, if you like, an Israel which is, I mean, absolutely two blocks which are irreconcilably almost opposed to each other. But the public opinion, as reflected in the polls, shows that the majority of Israelis, quite a clear majority of Israelis, support the government. Mm-hmm. They would support, there is majority support for military operation in Rafah. Have no mistake about it. Most Israelis want it. Most Israelis support the position about no Palestinian state. Overwhelmingly, Israelis support it. And so there has been this fundamental shift. And it has left the Ashkenazi, the liberal, sort of Europeanized left, really anxious and unhappy about this. And the right is becoming, when I said those three points, about the Temple Mount, about forming, about shaping Israel in terms of halakhic law, and all of this are very much at the other end of this idea of what is Judaism than for the Europeans. And the point is that America is, I mean, almost explicitly aligned now with, if you like, the Ashkenazi wing. And trying to use people like Gantz, who's in the war cabinet, but not in the cabinet, and Gallant, the defense minister, as a sort of an attempt to get rid of Netanyahu, because they believe this will bring about a change and the American policy for Gaza and for a solution in the region would be more easily facilitated. But perhaps that's making a bad mistake.
Highly interesting. What is the reason behind this shift to the right and behind this rise of religion? As an observer here from Switzerland, I can see that we have similar developments or comparable developments in the Arab world. What are the root causes of this political shift in Israel? Has it anything to do, for example, with the rise of Islamism, with Hamas getting into power in the Palestinian territories? Could you say something about that? Again, the further circumstances of this shift, because that's interesting that that Israel, in your eyes, has somehow changed its political character in the last 10, 15 years.
Yes, first of all, they saw the change taking place in Europe. The religious, if you like, the more religious Israeli, just as you've got conservative or traditionalist Christians who have, and you see this as being particularly in Russia, where Russia has adopted a very traditional form of orthodoxy, because it is suspicious of wokeism and of the Western sort of shift towards gender fluidity and all the things that they see as going against Christianity. And in the same thing, this was true in Israel, but you're right. Basically, from after the 2006 war, Israel was seeing Hezbollah getting stronger, Iran getting stronger, coming back. And so in about 2006, the Saudis talked with then the vice president, Dick Cheney, and suggested to him, look, we can change the whole balance in the region with Sunni Islam against Iran. And the main thing is to take out Syria. If we take out Syria, then Hezbollah and Iran are divided. Let's do that. And Dick Cheney said, well, whew, you know, we don't want to use Islamism like that, essentially. And this was Prince Bandar, who was in this meeting with him. And he said, we'll do it. Don't worry. You don't have to be involved. We'll do it. But the consequence of that was the firing up of Wahhabism. I mean, a long time, which is a very fundamentalist type of religion. They came basically out of the Najd in Saudi Arabia long ago, and was being, if you like, used, weaponized against Saudi Arabia, against Iran, for the Sunni cause, in order to make Sunnism, if you like, paramount. But this became very, it took a very fundamentalist form. And this made Israel very nervous and produced a very strong reaction in terms of, if you like, the religious Jews of all sorts, but particularly those Mizrahi who wanted to go back to something traditional. They saw themselves, and I think this is very important, rightly or wrongly, and there'll be people who will say they've got misunderstood things, don't understand Judaism properly. But the Mizrahi see themselves as the true Jews, and that the Ashkenazi are compromised, always willing to compromise and to enjoy a, you know, nice secular life. They're not ready, somehow not ready Jews. You see a parallel of that anyway in the Middle East, where, you know, some of the Islamic forces have said these people, you know, are not really Muslims at all, and therefore they can be killed. This was the sort of parallel things that were going on. I wrote about that 10, 12 years ago, that, you know, the religious symbols were going to become the source of the struggle. For years, we've been looking, for 20 years or so, we've been looking at the Israeli-Palestinian issue as essentially through sort of secular lenses, secular, liberal, Western lenses. The answer to this is two-state solution, and why doesn't everyone just come to terms with us and accept and be reasonable, and then the problem goes away. And I suppose for years and years I've been saying, it's just not going to happen. It's not, there will not be a two-state solution. It may sound very desirable. Of course it sounds desirable. And of course it's the bedrock of what policymakers always say, because that is the legal position. That is the UN Security Council position, two states on the lines of 67.
But practically, this two-state solution, as you explained, especially in Israel, in this growing religious dimension in politics, is quite far away at the moment. Let's jump back to our first question. Again, do you think that this that these proceedings now in Den Haag, are they justified? Is that the good decision now for the judges or for this prosecutor in Europe to jump in and say, okay, let's bring Netanyahu and the Hamas guys, let's bring them to justice, let's bring them in front of a court? What is your Salomonic decision or assessment of this new development we see now, actually?
Well, I'll say something perhaps that people haven't really sort of expected about this, but I've seen this over the a long time. Netanyahu had a bad experience with President Clinton. Clinton treated him, very badly. He treated him like dirt. And then, and afterwards, we had with Obama, we had a period where Netanyahu used Obama essentially as a punching bag, and used it whenever his polls were slipping. He would blame Obama and the United States for everything. And this, actually, every time he did this, his polls went up and increased. I just want to check you're still hearing me, because your image.
No,
is...
no, absolutely. No, I'm hearing you. And I see,
okay.
we have to explain, you are now in Rome, which means that, of course, the lively atmosphere of Rome somehow interfere within our discussion, which doesn't take our focus away at all.
That's good. You froze for a minute. That's why I...
No. I'm...
So look, this is what it is, in a sense. After his experience with Clinton, Netanyahu discovered that this, as the Israeli public was moving to the right too, hitting at Obama. And you remember he then went and actually argued against Obama in Congress. I mean, a foreign leader went and criticized this was a nuclear deal with Iran in front of Congress against their own president, something that was unforgivable, you might say. But every time that Netanyahu did this, his polls go higher and higher. Mm-hmm. And now he's doing the same game with Biden. Every time, what's happened? Why can't we have a victory? It's because Biden won't let us go into Rafah properly. Now, I know this is, I'm not arguing that he's right or arguing his point of view. I'm just saying this is the politics that is. Mm-hmm. It is what it is. And he uses this against Biden and against Washington to say, it's not me, it's not the government, but we're always being held back by the Americans who won't let us go forward and get the great victory that we all want. And this, again, is sort of manner for him to be now charged like this, along with Hamas, sort of pari passu. Most Israelis are outraged that there should be a moral equivalence is given. And of course, they will see this and will strengthen the sort of the sense of anti-Americanism, which is growing in Israel, partly because of Washington's policy, which is really, in some sense, to try and force the government to fall, regime change in Israel. So they're pushing people like Gantz and Gallant to say, why don't we have a proper policy for Gaza after the war? And if you don't have this and we don't get the Saudis involved in it, then I mean, we'll be stuck there forever. And what we need is a new policy. But for the moment, Netanyahu has 64 seats in the 120-seat parliament. Gantz is not in the government. It doesn't make any difference. If he resigns from the war cabinet, but he's not part of the government as such in terms of seats in the parliament, in the Knesset. And Gallant, the defense minister, is a member of Likud, the ruling party. And he did not consult with Likud before making the sort of threats to the government. So it's regarded increasingly in Israel that Secretary Blinken is in alliance with Gantz and Golan to bring down the government and to try and install one which is more favorable towards American policy. And the question is, who has the most influence? Is it Netanyahu or the White House? Given that Netanyahu and Israel have huge power structures in the US, in Congress, and elsewhere. And so now it's becoming a trial of strength, if you like, between Netanyahu on one hand and the Biden administration on the other, as who can control most. And as you've seen, the reaction has been in Washington. This is outrageous, the ICC accusation. I mean, 21 of them, I think it was, of the senators said, they dare to do this. We'll be coming for them. The judge better watch out. The Khan, Mr. Khan from the main prosecutor of the ICC. We're going to sanction him and we're going to attack him. So, I mean, actually, has it been a benefit or a detriment to Netanyahu? In the perspective of the government, which, as I say, is not the perspective shared by many other Israelis, this will be seen again as the West, with their sort of hypocrisy and their lack of understanding of what Israel suffered on the 7th of October, trying to make a moral equivalence.
Do you think that the war that Netanyahu is waging in Gaza against his enemies, the Hamas, is this a justified war? And is the way he wages this war, is that justified? I mean, the people in Switzerland, the media, I would say generally pro-Israel, they still criticize Netanyahu. He's a extremely polarizing politician at the moment, and they say he's damaging the cause of the Jews. This is a bit the argument we can read. I bring in another argument and I say, I mean, what alternatives did Netanyahu have after the 7th of October? I mean, we can talk about the root causes of the 7th of October a bit later, but if we could focus for a moment on Netanyahu. I mean, it's so difficult to fight an enemy who hides under civilian, hospitals, schools, etc. I mean, it's as if the Hamas has calculated, civilian casualties. How do you assess Netanyahu as a war prime minister and what he does? What is justified? What is not justified? What he does in your eyes?
Well, first of all, I think the general sort of consensus is a severe misreading, because it's much more complicated in the sense that this has been planned. The operation by Hamas has been planned over years. As you rightly say, you can't just sort of isolate everything and start at the 7th of October, but this has been planned. The resistance and the axis of resistance, which includes Hezbollah, which includes the Iraqi militia, which includes, if you like, Yemen and the Houthi forces, are coordinated loosely in strategic terms, but not necessarily in tactical terms. And this has been planned over years. And it's not it's totally propaganda when they say that Hamas is hiding within the population. Hamas is actually 70 meters down in these tunnels that have been prepared over many years, which are very sophisticated, which large. They're at 70 meters, deeper than even these big 2,000-pound bombs can reach. The JDAM bombs don't penetrate. They have nearly 450 kilometers of these tunnels under running the extent of Gaza. They contain hospitals, they contain sleeping quarters, they contain the mechanical factories for manufacturing weapons and for moving. They have roads 70 meters down under the tunnels. It's nothing to do with what's going on. So, in tactical terms, I mean, what is happening is a nonsense. Bombing the superstructure, if you like, bombing the surface area of buildings, kills civilians. Doesn't affect Hamas. They have a series of these deep tunnels and then what I call throwaway tunnels. These are one-use tunnels. They just have one tunnel, they come up, put explosive devices on Israeli tanks. They go down through another tunnel, both of them destroyed. Both those tunnels are blown up. And they hope that Israelis will be in them when they blow them up. But if they're not, they're not, they're destroyed. And then they build another. They have all the mining equipment underneath Gaza. And so this is not, there's no simple, there's no answer to this really at the moment. Hamas have, when before they started, the capacity to last a year, 2 years. During this time of war, when Israel says they've destroyed 24 battalions and another four are left in Rafah, you know, this is just nonsense because, you know, this we're not talking conventional war. Hamas don't operate. They're a guerrilla force. They operate in small groups. They don't have a formal structure like we would have in the West with a battalion commander operating. It works very completely differently. And so it was bound to fail. I think there was a thought that they could just go in and it would be an easy victory, short victory. Victory would be had and Israel would get back to its position. Israel is in deep trouble. Because, first of all, it's failed in Gaza. It's not, it's done some small damage to Hamas, but Hamas is intact and will continue. And in fact, over the last week or so, there's been a big upsurge in fighting. Israel has had sustained big losses in it. This is why there's such concern, because they don't, there's no answer to this. The Hamas forces are largely intact at 70 meters down. And they communicate, they can move up and down Gaza. They're not stuck in Khan Yunis or in Rafah, and then, you know, they can be isolated and a siege put on them. They just get in the vehicles and the motorbikes underneath the ground. This has been long planned, and this is very difficult. I mean, you know, conventional thinking doesn't work with this.
And
And
why
then you
is that?
have Hezbollah as well at the in the northern side, and they've now taken some of Israel's territory. This is now they've taken it as a no-go zone.
And what is the rationale then behind these bombings? I mean, the Israeli armed forces are said to be very competent. They have a war-proven leadership. I mean, there is a high esteem of these forces. So what's the rationale? Why are they bombing the houses when they cannot hit the infrastructure of Hamas?
Because certain of the military leaders and the others leaders, people like well, it doesn't matter, but senior generals in Israel said from the outset, you know, what we want to do is to remove the population, to force them to flee out of Gaza, and then for the settler movements, they want to go back and put settlements into Gaza. So the aim, and you know, people look at this and you say, well, you know, but this isn't really the government policy. But I think if I go back, you know, some years ago, 10 years ago, Netanyahu was interviewed for a book by Max Hastings in the 70s, I think it was later. And he said, listen, in the next war, if we do it right, there won't be any Arabs left in between the river and the sea, except for ones that accept accept to work for us. So this is a view. So this is a real sense. And this is what was at the beginning of what happened on 7th of October. First, there is the preparations now for rebuilding the Temple Mount and for knocking down. The settlers have been storming the Temple Mount and Al-Aqsa Mosque, and they did that 2 days before the 7th of October. And for Muslims everywhere, this is, I mean, unbelievable. As a sort of in a symbolic sense, and as I say, the policy of the government is no Palestinian state. The policy is displacement, population displacement, and so I mean there were advocates, and you probably heard if you followed at all the ICJ thing. There were advocates in the government to starve Gaza out. To stop the water supply, to stop the food supply, to put maximum pressure. And there were others in the government who said, you know, we want to make Gaza unlivable so that the people, and then perhaps these Arab states or Europeans will take them. They can go. We don't mind. They can go. Maybe we'll open Rafah and they can go into Egypt and they can live in the Sinai. But there was a very strong sense. And this goes back to the idea that there's no Palestinian state possible, for which for a majority of Israelis, it's not just the government, but the majority of Israelis do not believe it's possible to live alongside Palestinians in any structure because they will not be safe. One of the two things that's really changed so dramatically was, you know, there was a sense, there was a social contract with the government that Israelis could live anywhere on the land of Israel and know that the Israeli military had their back and the government had their back. That was blown up. The concept was blown up on the 7th of October. And worse for many, many Israelis was the sense, not only that, but now we are not feared in the region any longer. We are, after that happened, we aren't feared and we don't have deterrence. And therefore, Israel cannot survive without deterrence. So we need a big victory. If it's not going to be available in Gaza, is it going to be available in the north, in Lebanon? Is it going to be available by fighting or attacking Iran? I mean, these are the big questions that are coming. Yeah. And I just want to underline, because it's not picked up at all in the West, and it's very important to understand that political divide, which I mentioned in the beginning between the Ashkenazi and the Mizrahi, is now reflected in another divide, which is that about plurality of Israelis now believe that a new Holocaust opened on the 7th of October, began. Not in it, but began on the 7th of October. And that this is an existential fear. Now, sitting comfortably as we are, you in Switzerland and me in Rome, this may seem far-fetched, but this is a true reflection of how a plurality of Israelis are getting very and existentially fearful of that. They believe that the Hamas objective and the Islamic objective is to annihilate Jews. It's not true, but that is how they authentically fear this. And the other half believes in some sort of compromise in the American way, you know, going back to a two-state solution, which is not available. I can explain why it won't happen. The Saudi Arabia is not going to sign up to normalization.
There is a huge discussion now going on about Israel, harsh critics blaming Israel for some kind of genocide. In those debates, I argue against it, and I say, well, the Israeli troops, they warn civilians before they attack, or they have humanitarian corridors. This is not what the Nazis did, making their genocide like 80 years ago. So I'm very critical about these kind of assessments. I think they're totally emotional and too crass, probably in the light of the European history. But I mean, you are much closer to the events, what is actually happening there. What would you say about this discussion? I mean, is Israel really about to have huge war crimes there? And is this a totally unjustified kind of warfare that is going on right now in Gaza?
First of all, I mean, we have to, I think, for Europeans, become very uncomfortable with the idea of eschatological impulses driving politics and with biblical effects. But this is the reality, if you like, in the Middle East now. Over these years, it has become much more driven by this. And Israel is driven by this biblical idea of founding the land of Israel. And what is more, that they feel this is not an option, this is mandatory. This is in halakhic law. Israelis are obliged to pursue this. Much, perhaps you could say, as Islamists are obliged when a jihad is called to take part in jihad. And they do use this biblical reference of Amalek. I mean, the prime minister has used it, has said it, and we see it taking place. We see it in Gaza, where the rabbis
Amalek,
are coming.
Amalek is the word. You might Amalek, explain yeah. what it means.
Amalek is the word, and it refers back to a passage in the Bible in Isaiah, where Yahweh instructed Saul, King Saul, to destroy the Amalek, to kill them. And he said specifically, to kill their wives, the women, the children, the beasts, everything were to be destroyed utterly. And so this is used quite frequently. And you can hear the rabbis, I've seen videos and I see it quite a lot, these young soldiers, these reservists, dancing to sort of rap music and singing for Amalek in Gaza, because as I say, it's really taken a hold. And they talk about this and they say, you know, bang, 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 I've killed some Palestinians. Bang, 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 I want to kill more. It has taken a very strong, if you like, impulse. And it is connected with the idea of the Nakba, of the removal. As I said to you, I think you had it, perhaps I'm repeating myself, but Netanyahu, even in an interview in the 70s, talking to Max Hastings, the author, and he said, if we do the next war with the Palestinians right, there will be no Arabs here after the war at all. So, I mean, this has been growing as the idea that it's part of this idea that, you know, a Palestinian state is not feasible. We cannot live alongside each other. I mean, you know, this is something that is complicated because, settler colonialism has had very different outcomes. If you go to South America, you know, the Portuguese who were colonialists in Brazil married the indigenous population. And now they're all mixed up in the sort of Portuguese elite families are all somewhat Brazilian. In the north, the Spanish came into places like Colombia and Medellin, and they killed everybody. And they have a settler, and it is an extremely violent and, if you like, completely different experience than the two. Well, it now appears that it is not possible for Israel to come to some sort of terms with the indigenous population. This is a majority view in Israel. And so they see the only option is to remove them, that they must go. Because if this doesn't happen, then ultimately Israel will not be able to survive. So this has become, this is why I said it's an existential view. I mean, some in Israel would disagree and say, well, we can try and go back to the old normal. But the old normal for most Israelis was just, yes, we had a two-state solution. It was the apartheid state, and it hasn't worked. And what, how can we go back to that again? It just built up frustrations, and sooner or later the Palestinians will react and revolt again. This doesn't work. The only solution is that they must go, and we will have another nightmare. It doesn't mean as you say, genocide. It means that, as Smotrich says, we give them the option. Either they submit to us and accept our dominance, or they then leave. And they can go where they want, but those that stay accept that we are in charge. And that's, he's a minister in the cabinet. And this is, he set this out some years ago and said, you know, the Palestinians needs to be taken off the table. When you frame it in this, you know, really fundamental way, you know, what else, what is the future for Israel other than this? It's either a huge sort of Armageddon war against everyone, in which Israel would have a huge victory as they see it. Deterrence would come back and they would be saved. But else, what are they going to go on with? What's going to happen? They can't succeed in Gaza. Are they going to allow Gaza to continue with Hamas running it as a symbol of resistance against them? Which is, you know, that's why Netanyahu says, you know, I don't accept these plans from coming from Washington. No, there's no solution. We face difficult options.
How do you see Hamas? I mean, this is an organization which is not so easy to assess. We had in our newspaper, like 20 years ago, we had this famous Charta, where which seemed to justify all the existential sorrows that Israelis have vis-à-vis this organization, where Hamas said, we have to get rid of the state of Israel, we have to kill all the Jews. So, like an existential threat, like a threat of annihilation from the side of Hamas. But then, of course, they argue this Charta is a bit going into, you know, has been into retreat, etc. But Hamas, how do you see this organization, especially after this this massacre at the 7th of October 2023? What's Hamas? How does do we have to assess this organization?
Well, as you know, I was, if you like, working for the High Representative of the European Union in Gaza during these periods. And so I know Hamas quite well. And I know the founder, I knew the founder of Hamas,
Sheikh Yassin.
Sheikh Yassin, Ahmed Yassin, who was paraplegic. He was a shrunken little figure in his wheelchair with his hearing aid buzzing and squeaking all the time. And it was very difficult to know whether he actually heard everything you said. And he had the most piercing, intelligent eyes I have come across. Very intelligent man, hard, tough man. But he said to me something that shocked me. And he said it very clearly. And he said, listen, Hamas is not an Islamic movement. And I said, what? It's not. He said, no, we're not an Islamic movement. We're not even, you know, we're not Islamic at all. We are a liberation force. We are solely concerned with liberating from occupation. We are an anti-occupation, anti-colonial force. And he said, anyone can join. Anyone can join it. You can be Muslim or you can be Christian. And he pointed at me and he said, you can join it if you want. You can belong to us. And it's a misunderstanding of Hamas The Gaza Hamas is quite different from the Hamas that you see and you hear that were in Damascus and are now in Doha. These are the sort of political committee. The Gaza one is quite different. And it called itself, and it was very significant, it called itself the Al-Aqsa, if you like, flood. Al-Aqsa because Al-Aqsa is a symbol not of Muslim Brotherhood, not of Wahhabism, not of Sunni, not of Shi'i. It is because it reflects, if you like, the essence of Islam itself. And so what we're seeing is a sort of new form of Islamism, a sort of, for the first time in many years, nationalism. Islamist is, if you like, Islamic nationalism, Arabic nationalism is merging, if you like, together with this anti-colonial liberation structure. So it's very different. It's not, and Israel being removed from the map, I mean, many states have gone from the map at some time. It doesn't mean they are annihilated, their people are annihilated. What the resistance wants, and it's been set out very clearly by Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, who's spokesman for some the resistance in one way. He says, you know, what we have to do is we have to exhaust Israel, exhaust it, defeat it, get it to the point where it's desperate. And then we have to sit down with it and accept a new outcome whereby no one has special rights, special privileges, but we all live on the land with similar, equal rights. So this is what is the objective. In that case, there won't be an Israel. I mean, Israelis will be there, but not Zionism. The Zionism of special rights, special privileges will be gone.
Do you think it's a wise decision? For example, the Swiss government talks about forbidding Hamas, saying this is a criminal terrorist organization of mass murderers. One should never talk to them. We should forbid them. We should put them on a criminal list. What's your opinion about that?
I think that's a great mistake. I've spent most of my career opening channels and talking to people that other people wouldn't talk to. I mean, I've been, you know, I talk to Hezbollah, I talk to Iran, I talk to all of these groups. I've known them from the beginning. Some of them have moved from being terrorists to suddenly being members of a government and vice versa. And then people in the government have become terrorists. I don't really, you know, necessarily approve of that language. I think it actually is an attempt to stop communication. Mm-hmm. But more worse than that, it's an attempt to stop thinking critically about who people are, why they say the things that they mm-hmm. say. I have always followed the simple recipe. If I hear people saying something and I really don't understand it, and I really can't know, I mean, why did they say such a thing? Mm-hmm. Then I think maybe the problem is mine, not theirs. Maybe it's because I don't understand properly mm-hmm. the situation. And then I've always felt you have to be like a terrier dog, stick your teeth into the sort of the trouser leg of this problem and work out, you know, what is it they're saying? Why are they saying mm-hmm. it? And what is the proper response? I mean, for years, I mean, I was in Afghanistan at the time when Osama bin Laden. I knew Osama bin Laden there. And I went, you know, to Washington and I said, you know, you have to understand, you have to discriminate and understand what is happening in just don't call it all political Islam. Oh, that's awful. This is an enemy. We terrorism. We can't do this because you're just defining your identity in terms of a complete opposition to some other identity, an alien, external enemy that is to be destroyed mm-hmm. in any way possible. But when you do that, you trap yourself in your narrative. Your narrative is, you know, I'm liberal, I'm a civilized person. These people are animals, these people are extremists and things like that. Well, how do you get out of that? You end up having to go to war. war on terror or the war here or war against Russia, whatever it is, you end up because the narrative provides no bridges to get out of that narrative.
If you create monsters, it's also an excuse to destroy diplomacy or to bury diplomacy.
Exactly.
An observation, I would be curious what you think about it. My impression is, I'm not a diplomat. I mean, I speak here as a journalist. Of course, I totally respect you're a diplomat. You have a very differentiated way of expressing things. To me, I see a cynical attitude on the side of many Arab states vis-a-vis the Palestinians. For example, I mean, there is great outrage, justified outrage, that there are so many civilian deaths now in Gaza. There are so many civilian deaths now in Gaza. But isn't it so that, for example, Egypt does not open its borders for refugees from Palestine? You know, that they say, okay, we welcome the Palestinians, but we rather keep the Palestinians within Gaza, within Israel, in order to create like a disturbing factor, like a proxy army or something to destabilize Israel. So the Palestinian people is also used as a weapon against Israel, and there is a certain cynicism on the side of the Arab countries. What do you think
there
about
are two.
That?
There are two. I mean, the reading of Egypt, I think, is almost totally inverted. The reason that Egypt won't open the gates of Rafah is because they are dancing on the edge of a volcano. The leadership is not popular. They have huge economic problems. They've just devalued the Egyptian pound. It's fallen by 30%. That's in a country where just about half the population lives on less than $2 family income a day. It's just, I mean, dramatic. And Egypt has a history of revolutions. And the government has very few roots in it. It is controlled by the army's elite. They are terrified that if Hamas and its supporters came in to Egypt, there would be revolution and they would be gone. They fear revolution. So this is why they won't do it. They are absolutely adamant that, you know, it's easy. Look, the colonels and the senior generals are pro-American and pro-Western. That's not the case for the 90% of the army who are struggling. And these are radical, and they're becoming, everything that they see in Gaza is making more radical, more against the government, more against America, more against Israel. And it's the same in most of the Arab world, but the big elites of the Arab world, who now see themselves more as hedge fund managers. You know, I used to go to some of those Gulf states, and you'd see the emir's sort of head of office, and he's got all his Bloomberg screens coming up, and he's sort of trading. And some of those want to be seen as a sort of, you know, a titan of Wall Street more than they want to run their countries. So there are a few of those, but I can tell you the Arab world is seething with anger. It's not going to be the same again. The ordinary, whether it is in Jordan or Egypt, and in fact, there's an Israeli general called General Brick. And before the invasion of Gaza by Israel, he went to see Netanyahu. He's a respected man. Netanyahu saw him several times. He's one of the, you know, strategic generals. And he said, I've got some questions to answer you, to ask you before you go into Gaza. And the first question was, are you sure that Jordan and Egypt will survive the stresses of a war in Gaza? Prime Minister, are you sure that they can survive that? And what if they can't? And the second issue was, he said, are you sure that the Israeli forces actually have a plan for when they go into Gaza? Do they know what to do? Have you seen the plan? And of course, there were no answers to either of these sort of key questions. And we see, and the same question, Jordan is really on the edge, very much on the edge. Most of the Jordanians are Palestinian by origin. And there's even Saudi Arabia, a poll showed that 86% of the population, 86% wanted to sever all links with Israel. Now, the elites, the big, you know, the oligarchs, the wealthy billionaires and so on, you know, have got their assets tied up in America and in Europe and are not so keen. But even so, you know, all this talk about Saudi Arabia sort of normalizing has to be understood that Mohammed bin Salman is the crown prince, but he is not the king. And in the doctrine in Saudi Arabia is that is known as Wali al-Amr, and it means absolute monarchy. You cannot contest anything that the monarch says. The family has to obey it. It's absolute monarchy, and MBS follows that and adheres to that. Well, even though the king is not in a compass state, a state that is capable of saying something, in 2002, he launched, that was Abdullah, launched this initiative. And the initiative was called the Arab Initiative for Peace. And it set out in writing that normalization with Israel will only happen after a Palestinian state takes place, not as a sort of nudge wink, well, if you do this, maybe there's a Palestinian state. That is why bin Salman says we can only normalize if there's irrevocable movement towards a Palestinian state, because that's what the Wali wrote. And even if he's crown prince, he cannot move away from that. Now, if in the next week or so the king is seriously ill in hospital, move from the clinic in the palace into a hospital with high temperature and pneumonia. If he dies, then there is a council of the family. It doesn't mean that MBS automatically ascends and becomes the king. There is a council, and that can change the succession if it deems it. So he's saying the nice things to Americans because he wants American support in the succession, and doesn't mean necessarily he's going to stick with it or do it. But he needs the Americans not to go against him because it's going to be very touch and go, because there are many people who have better claims to be king under the tradition of Saudi Arabia than just MBS, older brothers even. So, I mean, this is what's going on there as much as anything. And Americans playing it up, but it's not always what it seems to be.
I'm asking myself, what is actually the goal of Hamas? And is Hamas reaching its goal now? I would probably Hamas, or I ask, does Hamas want a two-state solution, or does Hamas want to create this tsunami wave in the Arab world against Israel, that Israel is somehow as a state wiped out, therefore justifying all the existential threat feelings on the side of the Israelis, and especially the religious right in Israel? And are these calculations adding up now for Hamas? But first, what's the goal of Hamas? Two-state solution, or wipe out Israel, create this tsunami wave against the Jewish state? And secondly, is Hamas successful, actually, with the, of course, I mean, by risking and sacrificing their own people in this bomb war by Israel?
Yes, I mean, your last question first. Sinwar absolutely expected what has happened in Gaza. He was been in prison in Israel for 20 years. He's written a novel. He understands that a sort of situation where you have nothing to lose. And he sees this as revolutionary. What I mean by revolutionary politics, he wanted to blow up the paradigm that has been going on, occupation. Israel comes in and they call it mowing the grass, killing some Palestinians, go back, ceasefire, then we go back to occupation. And he wanted to blow up that paradigm and bring the Palestinian issue right back, front and center to international politics. He's done that. He's also broken the paradigm because, as I say, Israelis no longer believe that they can live anywhere on the land of Israel, what they call, well, Israel as it is now, safely. And he's increased the sort of, he's destroyed that deterrence. And he's also, what's happened has destroyed the idea that Israel is feared by the whole of the Middle East, and therefore has deterrence in the bigger sense. Especially, you know, with the involvement of Hezbollah. What is the purpose of it? It is, as I say, it was set up by Hassan Nasrallah, who's the spokesman for the resistance on this, the head of Hezbollah. And he said, the aim of this is basically attrition, rather like you've seen taking place in Ukraine, is the attrition of Israel, economic attrition, the cutting off of supplies, attrition in Gaza, attrition in West Bank, attrition from Yemen, attrition from Iraq, attrition from Hezbollah. All of these pressures so that Israel feels the walls closing in on them. And at some point, they will, in despair, turn around and say, we need to think again. You know, what is the purpose of Zionism? We need to rethink Zionism. Is there another way of living in this region in a different way? And I think it's we're nowhere near that at this point. But the solution was given to me by an Israeli some time ago. What we will ultimately get to is we will come to the conclusion we have to talk to Iran. And, you know, America will go wild. We will start it. America will follow, and finally, at the end of the line, will be the Europeans, and they will understand that the only way out of this dilemma is for us to sit down and talk about the future and how, if you like, Israel or the Jewish people that live on what is now Israel can continue to live in it. After all, Jews have lived for 300 years. Very successfully in Iran and in other places, and enjoyed actually greater privileges in some cases than the citizens. So it's not the killing of all of the population. On the contrary, Hassan Nasrallah in his last speech said, I think this can be done without a big war. I think we're getting there. Eventually, the Israelis will see that Zionism, this is different. The Zionists is a project for special rights, special privileges for Jews live against people who live on the same land, but with inferior rights, with no security, with no fixed boundaries, with no state. That is over and finished. And eventually, I think Israel will have to see and consider itself. The project, the Zionist project per se, has failed because it was not possible to come to terms with the indigenous population from the outset. The 48 involved the Nakba, the cleansing of the Palestinians, driving them into refugee camps where some of them still are in places like Syria. It hasn't worked, and I think many Israelis understand that. But it's hard to move to the next stage of saying, well, you know, well, what can we do about it? And this is where Netanyahu is stuck and why he says these things which sound so outrageous in the West. I at least can understand what he's saying. He's saying, if we don't have a big victory, then, you know, we have to rethink the whole project, you know. And for Zionists, that's very difficult to hear that. But he's saying, we need the victory. We've got to have a big victory. Armageddon, in other words, to restore fear, to restore deterrence, to survive here. And in a way, I'm not sort of advocating it in any way, but I understand what he says because, the other side of the equation is saying, why don't we go back to the two-state solution and we can try and do, and it hasn't worked for all these years since 48, and was perhaps prejudiced from the beginning of 48 and cannot be retrieved. And many Israelis understand that, but it creates this existential fear. What is the future? Will our grandchildren be able to live here or not? Ultimately, there will have to be a discussion, and it will probably have to be with Iran, not with Saudi Arabia, because Iran is the key.
I have one last question. I mean, it's so fascinating, and one could talk even longer because it's such a wide field. Thank you very much. But I've got one last question. I mean, you are an expert in conflict solution. You have negotiated, you have been in very difficult situations. And if I understand it correctly, we have here a really a complicated issue. On the one hand, we have the Israelis who truly believe, and justifiably so, that in some respect, that the other side, they want to kill us, they want to get rid of us, they want to wipe us out. On the other hand, you have probably a similar sensibility. They say it's totally unjust what Israel is doing. It's this kind of colonial garrison state, which is the occupying force here and taking away the rights of people who have lived here from hundreds of years. Now, what would be your solution if you have two parties that are so, how do you say, so deep into their own worldview, which seems to be mutually exclusive? How can you bring that together? How can you build trust? And this in the light of a conflict that, as you explained, at the moment is fought out in biblical terms, which means going back thousands of years. I mean, how can you build trust in such a situation? What do you say as a professional negotiator?
I don't think I ever managed to get trust. I never looked for trust in it as a negotiator. I don't believe in it. What I do believe in is integrity. Many people, when I've negotiated with Islamic movements and others, they're not going to trust me. But after a time, they begin to believe that I have integrity. What I say is true. What I say will be, if I say I can, I can. If I say I can't, I can't. And I would keep very strictly when negotiating between Israel and Hamas, for example, which I did for some time. And I would always say to Israel, there's above the line, I will talk to you about what they say to me, and there's a below the line. So if you ask me who's at the meeting and where was it held, forget it. Any more than I will tell them these sort of details too. So I keep a very separate element. But the other thing is, and I think this is what I would contend, I'm not a diplomat and I'm not a peacemaker. And I know that because I have to recognize that actually these dynamics in politics and in the world are real dynamics. Sometimes, and I used to say this to Solana when he was high representative, you can't be like King Canute and you can't stand on the seashore and tell the tide to go out. I mean, you have to wait, and maybe when the tide changes, you can move a little bit here or there. So I understand because I've been in conflict for most of my career. Sometimes there has to be a trial of strength. The two sides have to clash and they have to come to understand their limitations and their strength. Maybe then something is possible. But the main thing is, it's impossible so long as both sides see that the other has no case. If neither side will see, look, I disagree with what you say, I disagree with your vision of the future, I cannot accept it, but at least I accept that that's your Palestinian vision or that's your biblical Israeli vision, and that both are authentic. Only then does politics come possible. But diplomats tend to rush in and say, give me the solution. I want a solution now. What's your solution today for this thing? Today, there isn't a solution at the moment. Will there be one? Maybe in, you know, some time. Maybe we'll have to go to a bigger war before we arrive at that point. These are realities. For me, I regard this, I mean, I don't welcome it, but this is the reality of life. Things are what they are, and you have to accept them. But diplomats tend to rush in, and they say, oh, well, we'll do this, and we'll have an Arab peacekeeping force in Gaza. Nonsense. It's not going to happen. And all this does is actually make things worse, and even more so, as I said to you, when you have a narrative, oh, everyone's terrorists, and these are defined, we define our identity in radical opposition to their identity, so that you can't talk to them. During the war on terror, it's impossible. I actually went on television once in Al Jazeera, and we had a debate, and I went on it with a CIA, senior official CIA officer, and myself, still representing the European Union. And we had a debate with the second head of Hezbollah and of Hamas for an hour on Al Jazeera television. And it had a viewing of some 50 million, which in those days was quite an effect on the whole region. Impossible today. Impossible. You can't do those sort of things. I mean, even to sort of, if you say anything about Hamas or what their actual objectives are, you're either a pro-Hamas or you're pro-Putin or you're a lackey of Z, whatever it is. So we have no bridges now. Now, I mean, that's why we're in such a dangerous position, both in Ukraine and in the Middle East. We don't have any way out of our narratives. And we're building more and more sort of narrative redoubts, whereby anyone that moves out of that position is going to be destroyed, or their reputations tainted for going out of that that formula.
But at least we have people such as you, and we have discussions where this problem is clearly seen. And at the moment when one sees a problem, this is or might be the first step to a solution. So let's hope that we'll find the bridges again, and that we somehow crawl out of these caves of mutual misunderstandings and personal absolutisms of own opinions. Thank you very much, Alistair Crook. This is this was a history lesson, first rate, first class, and also contemporary history. Many thanks for your time and for your expertise.
No, well, thank you for permitting me to be able to speak this way. Thank you so much.